service.
The 27 Club is a production of iHeartRadio and Double Elvis Media. Jim Morrison died at the age of 27, and he lived a life that routinely crossed the line from harmless prank to criminal activity. I can give you 27 reasons why that statement is true. 5 would be the number of years he would use his post as band leader to challenge ideals, battle norms, and provoke the easily provoked old guard of American society. 2 more would be the number of flights he missed as he drank his way across the country, trying to get from Los Angeles to Miami for the kickoff to the biggest tour of the Doors' career. 1 more would be the number of lambs he held in his arms on stage in front of 12,000 fans while he ranted at a crowd packed like sardines inside of an old airplane hangar in Miami. Another one would be the number of pants zippers he slowly, clumsily undid on that same stage. 16 more would be the number of people who would swear they saw Jim expose himself that night. In 2 would be the number of years he had left to live when the FBI showed up with warrants, handcuffs, and zero patience. And Jim, well, Jim was stoned somewhere in Jamaica. On this, our 6th episode of Season 2, FBI Warrants, Jamaican Spliff, and Jim Morrison, Lost in Another Fantasy. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is the 27 Club. Siddons had to dumb it down, explain it in layman's terms. Either he wasn't explaining himself clearly, or he was being played. The more frustrated he got, the more it felt like the latter, and these motherfuckers were playing him. "You do the math," Siddons said. "You do the math and you'll see why I think you're fucking us here, man. You said one thing and you're doing another. Now you're talking out of both sides of your mouth. You're fucking us." Siddons was 20 years old and had been the Doors' manager for barely a year. He'd been booking successful shows for months, and he had learned the ropes of the nascent rock tour biz as a roadie and a gopher. Dude was young, but a hustler, ambitious, on the ball. Bill had booked the Doors to play the Dinner Key Auditorium in Coconut Grove, Miami, on the first day of March 1969. But there was one problem. The promoter had purposefully overbooked the show to make more money and didn't include the band in on the extra take. It was their first stop on a huge North American tour that would take them to Pittsburgh, Philly, Toronto, Detroit, Dallas, Boston, Los Angeles. This was a bad omen to kick things off. The converted seaplane hangar, with its dramatic rafters and precarious stage, had a capacity of 7,000. The promoters decided to take out all the chairs on the floor to cram in more people and increase the capacity to 12,000, nearly double what the band had been contracted for. The Doors had been guaranteed $25,000 based on the venue generating a total of $42,000, more than half the total take, but there was no percentage cut in that deal. With the additional 5,000 ticket buyers, the promoters were looking to pocket close to $75,000. It was a slap in the face to the band. Bill was pissed. He was so pissed that he threatened to pull the plug on the whole show. And there was another problem, too. There were 2,000 fans outside the venue that didn't have tickets, and they wanted in. They congregated en masse outside the auditorium, pushed up against the doors and the walls, looked for windows on the second floor that they could be hoisted up to and scurry inside of. They were like rats fleeing the sinking ship, only they were trying to get into the ship. There didn't seem to be the proper amount of security on detail to prevent a mass rush or riot, and the kids outside didn't care if they had tickets or not. And they were going to get inside to watch the Doors play, one way or another. That is, if Jim Morrison would just show up. Jim was nowhere to be found. MIA. The more they all waited with no word from Jim, the more this third problem trumped Bill's first problem. Where the hell was Jim Morrison? Jim was late. He was on his way. He was somewhere between Miami and Los Angeles. Could be in the air or on the ground. Who knew? Only Jim. Jim had fought again with Pam that morning in LA. Pamela Corson was as close to a long-term relationship as Jim would get in his life, albeit a long-term relationship that was fraught with infidelity, deception, and apathy. Despite the fact that Pam would regularly refer to herself as Jim's girlfriend, and later his wife, Jim routinely slept with other women, but he always returned to her. She was steady. Pam was smart. She loved Jim, but didn't exactly trust him. She would sneak off to meet her heroin dealer in their Laurel Canyon neighborhood and score smack when Jim wasn't around. Jim did a lot of drugs, perhaps more than the average 1960s rocker, but he didn't touch heroin, and Pam knew it would set him off. They had been planning to go to Jamaica after his Miami show was over. A quick siesta, a recharge, just a spell, recharged the batteries for a week or so before the tour started up for real and things got crazy. Now it seemed like Jamaica might be off the table, the way they were arguing. It was another one of their usual fights. Pam was angry that Jim was drunk again and going away again, and where the hell had he been last night anyway? And Jim was irritated that he was getting the third degree. They both felt like they were being second-guessed by the other, and also both felt like they should be the only ones doing the second-guessing. And the difference was, this time, the fight went on a little longer than usual. They fought so long on this occasion that Jim lost track of the time and missed his flight. They told him he had to wait until the next flight headed east, so he started drinking. He drank at the airport bar. He was booked onto another flight and boarded. More drinks on the plane. As the stewardess walked by Jim's aisle seat, he stuck up his pointer finger and made a clicking noise with his tongue. She stopped and looked at Jim, who pushed his black sunglasses down to the bridge of his nose. He shook an empty rocks glass. Keep him coming, hon. There was a connection in New Orleans. He deboarded, found the airport bar, and kept drinking. He missed his connecting flight, waited for another, drank some more, boarded, more drinks. By the time he got to Miami, he was shit-faced. When Jim walked into the Dinner Key Auditorium, he was met by Bill and the band, who greeted him with a mixture of relief, gratitude, and extreme annoyance. Like they knew it was Jim being Jim, but Jim had taken the whole Jim being Jim thing to a new, uncomfortable level. Jim stank. The whole band could smell the booze on him like he had bathed in it before boarding the plane in New Orleans. His beard was thick. It oozed alcohol. He wore a wide-brimmed hat with a skull and crossbones. His whole vibe was anti-sunny L.A. It was the underbelly of L.A., where the smelly, drunk, couldn't-give-a-fuck freaks commingled. It was nearly 11 o'clock in the evening, and the band was an hour past the show's start time. Jim patted Bill on the back and looked at the doors. All right, fellas, let's go give him a show that they'll never forget. Jim held the lamb in his arms. It didn't make a sound. Even though it was on stage in front of 12,000 fans in a sweltering old seaplane hangar, the lamb played it cool. Its snow-white wool coat starkly contrasted Jim's dark outfit. His wide-brimmed skull and crossbones hat, light and dark on stage together in Miami. Jim, bearded with a belly full of whiskey, cradled the lamb, pet the top of its head softly, and looked out on the audience. He stretched his legs, which were tight from sitting on planes and in airport bars all day. Thousands of faces looked back at him in varying stages of expression, shock, elation, confusion. Some were captivated, others were horrified, and others still were incredibly stoned, and the looks on their faces were the ones that vacillated the most. Jim couldn't see the actual expressions on any of the faces staring up at him. To him, they all looked to be faces in rapture, hanging on his every word, eating up the tension, his hat, his beard, the lamb. What did it all mean, their expressions seemed to say to him. They'd never seen a Jim Morrison like this before. Playful, mysterious, coded, cool as shit. Or maybe, some of them thought to themselves, maybe he's just drunk. Jim, on the contrary, was so drunk he felt undrunk. He felt like he was about to do something different, give everyone a concert unlike any concert they'd seen before. An experience. That's what he'd give them. He couldn't put his finger on exactly what that meant, but he just knew it felt different, that he felt different, and he knew the audience would know it when they felt it. It wouldn't be what they were expecting, but it would be electrifying all the same. Jim thought of the living theater, of the thrill of it all, and the newness of it, and the shock of it. It was art. If the living theater could do it, why couldn't Jim Morrison? He could be art. Rock music could be art. Shit, he could make art in the middle of Florida. Jim surveyed the crowd and saw what he wanted to see. There weren't 12,000 fans. They weren't inside a converted airplane hangar. It was a small room. The lighting was low, intentional, arty. The corners of the room were dark. And there were people lurking in the shadows, people sitting cross-legged on the floor, backs straight, heads cocked, eyebrows raised, people standing up against the edge of the stage. And no one made a sound. They all hung on Jim's every word. Their bated breath was an aphrodisiac to Jim. The doors were riding the vamp of when the music's over, when Jim flapped his hand condescendingly towards them, like he was flagging a ride. But he didn't want a ride, he wanted them to stop. He wanted the music to be over, for real. It was his turn to do something different, to shine. To Jim, the whole room was waiting on him, waiting for entertainment, waiting for instruction. "Repeat after me," he shouted into the void.
"I need love!"
The crowd looked back at him like they were patrons analyzing an oil painting on the wall. It was just what Jim wanted. He was the painting on the wall. He was the art. They were adoring, scrutinizing patrons. Jim.
"I need some good loving. I ain't talking about no revolution. I ain't talking about no demonstration. I'm talking about a good time. Are you ready? Come on up here and love my ass."
Jim felt the roar of the crowd like a warm hug. The roar started as a vibration. It started as a feeling from their bodies to his that rumbled through the air. And then it was a sound of acceptance that was louder and more bone-rattling than any applause he had received. His crowd was small, but it was fierce. He put the lamb down on the stage, took off his skull and crossbones hat. He began to unbutton his white dress shirt slowly, one button at a time. And the crowd was his mirror. Those who were sitting stood up. Those who had hidden in the shadows in the corners of the room began to move forward, hands raised to their shirts, fingers grabbing their buttons. Shirts were lifted, pants dropped, shoes kicked off. The audience carefully liberated themselves from their clothes, one piece at a time. Jim's head spun. He'd been drinking since the morning, some beers at LAX, a few toddies for the body in New Orleans, and then the big bottle of Jack he snagged backstage here in Miami. Now he was taking the living theater's own alchemy to the next level. He was the puppet master. These people were his puppets. He spoke and they spoke. He moved and they moved. He took off his clothes and they took off their clothes. He jumped and they said, "How high?" Even Captain Morrison himself would be proud. It was like the Singer Bowl in Queens all over again. Except this time, the cops weren't patrolling the stage and shutting him down. This time, the cops were outnumbered and the audience was peacefully interacting. And there were no hurled chairs, no bleeding heads, no threats to the thin blue line. Jim felt like he was a magnet. He felt the slow wave of people rush towards him, felt the magnetic pull as it happened. He saw more people coming out of the shadows, saw more come down from the ceiling, saw more come up from the floor, saw more come in through the windows and scale the walls. Half naked, half undressed, more shirts came off, more pants, and then boxers and briefs and panties and socks. He unbuckled his belt buckle and really got into his theatrical groove. He started to repeat phrases over and over again like the living theater had done. Now that he had an entire room pulsing along with his pulse and breathing along with his breath, he wanted to disorient them, throw them for a loop.
"Are you ready?"
he asked, and then repeated it over and over again.
"Are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready?"
Are you ready? Jim realized that Ray's keyboard bass was the only sound coming from the band now. It pounded rhythmically like a heartbeat. Jim repeated the mantras from earlier about no revolution and no demonstration, about having fun, and the crowd threw them back at him. The band hadn't been playing a song for a while now, just Ray's insistent bass line. The room was hot, intense, the crowd was restless. And Jim stuck his thumb in the waist of his leather pants and pulled down, exposing flesh below his waist, a trail of hair on his torso. He thought of the Living Theater, thought of the liberation of their performance, the liberation of the audience, the Living Theater fantasy. He pulled down harder on the waist of his pants and leaned into the microphone. You showed me yours. Now how about I show you mine? Ray, Robbie, and John surveyed the damage at the Dinner Key Auditorium in Miami. It was a lot to take in. The stage was in pieces, busted beyond repair. One half of the rickety old seaplane hangar had collapsed in on the other half. There was debris everywhere, beer bottles and wine bottles strewn across the floor, bras, underwear, shirts, pants. You could practically smell the broken promise of some kind of fantastical liberation. It hung in the muggy, stale air, along with the smells of body odor, of red wine, of Jack Daniels and lamb's wool. It was the morning after the Miami show, and the doors were staring down the cold light of day. They had a bigger problem than a broken stage, and that problem was once again nowhere to be found. Jim had bailed. He did the Miami thing and then left for the Jamaica thing, the vacation he had promised Pam. The calm before the storm of the rest of this tour, the band's biggest tour ever. But now, it looked like there wouldn't be any tour. Not now. Maybe not ever. Jim had fucked it all up. High on that Living Theater shit. He thought he was leading a bunch of attentive students down the primrose path. Thought he was giving an intimate performance to a high art audience. But that didn't happen at all. Didn't happen the way Jim had imagined it. The whole thing was far less romantic and idealistic than Jim had thought it was. Jim yelled at them, berated them. He repeated words over and over again like he wasn't able to think of any other words in the English language besides, "Are you ready?
Are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready?"
Ready for what, Morrison? Ray, Robbie, and John wanted to know. So did the kids that packed the Dinner Key Auditorium. They were ready for a rock and roll show, and instead they got some glorified performance art. And now, the next morning, the doors were picking up the pieces, literally. The Dinner Key Auditorium was originally one of Pan Am's airplane hangars, a seaplane base to be exact, that was converted into an exhibition hall and an auditorium in the early 1950s. The auditorium was host to graduations, parties, and political rallies, but despite its aviation roots, it was known locally as a dump. It was abandoned, it smelled, it was decaying in double time, home to transients. In a word, the place was a mess. And Jim was a mess the night before. He really gave it to the crowd. He told them they were idiots, told them they were slaves, that they did what they were told. He told them they were all a bunch of sheep, and to drive the point home, he held a lamb in his arms. He took cheap shots at Florida, sang the praises of Los Angeles. He big-timed them, and they weren't hip enough, weren't liberated enough. He waxed poetic like he wasn't the Florida man himself, Hollywood gutter trash who had merely liberated himself from the Sunshine State swamp. At one point during the show, while Robbie was taking a guitar solo, Jim dropped to his knees right in front of him, stuck out his tongue, pretended to give head to Robbie's guitar. He did unbuckle his belt buckle. He did pull the zipper of his pants down. He did ask the crowd if they wanted to see it, if they wanted him to take it out, the crawling king snake. And now there were reports that Jim had exposed himself to 12,000 fans. Doesn't matter what he thought he was doing or what he thought he was. This was the reality. The show was ridiculously oversold, and there were lots of conflicting reports as to what actually happened. It all happened so fast. and the crowd had surged to Jim's insistence. He egged them on just like he always did, just like he had at the Singer Bowl. It was hot, humid as fuck. It could have been a mass hallucination or mass hysteria, an illusion. Or maybe it had been real. Maybe he had really done it. Ray, Robbie, and John wouldn't put it past him. If Jim Morrison was gonna whip out his dick, Jim Morrison was gonna whip out his dick. First, people pushed their way onto the stage. Then they were pushing each other on the stage. And then Jim started to push anyone who brushed up against him. The line between the audience and the band had been erased. Full audience participation. Prelude to a riot. No way out, no way in. Jim pushed a few more people. He thought one of them was a cop, and then he hoped it had been a cop. Kids ran into him, almost knocked him over. No one gave a shit that he was Jim Morrison. He was just another body, just in the way. And Jim kept shoving. Jim shoved the wrong guy, and the guy, twice Jim's size, flipped him head over heels into the audience. It was around that time that the promoter pulled the plugs out of the wall and shut it all down. The music stopped, the house lights came on, the audience reeled and screamed and saw the whole scene in a different light. Jim picked himself up off the floor, and it was over. There were reports that Jim had tossed cops around on stage before the plug was pulled, after he had repeatedly shouted obscenities into the microphone, and, as some claimed, exposed himself. The Miami Herald called out the cops who saw it all happening and didn't do anything about it. But there had been a sense that night that a real riot could take place if the cops had actually gotten involved. The next morning, as the Doors saw the future of their tour in the dirty aftermath of its first show, Miami officials questioned why this had been allowed to happen in the first place. The president of the Crime Commission of Greater Miami insisted that a grand jury investigation be launched to look into Jim's supposed exposure. A few days later, Jim was officially charged and a warrant was issued for his arrest. He was being charged with one felony, lewd and lascivious behavior, and three misdemeanors, indecent exposure, open profanity, and drunkenness. And they said he whipped it out, tossed it around, shook it, grabbed it in his hand, and got a couple quick jerks off. And the Miami police chief was ready to make an example of Jim Morrison, even if he was a local boy made good. He may be the Florida man in spirit, but he wasn't Florida's anymore. He was some loudmouth Hollywood big-timer who told the audience that night that he got smart when he left Florida and headed west. He was too good for them, like the sun shone on his ass and his ass alone. The chief wasn't about to cut him any breaks. He would personally see to it that Jim sit in a cell in Rayford Prison for over 7 years. Jim would get fat and bitter in jail. They would throw the book at him. Maximum sentence for a maximum asshole. Only problem was, Jim Morrison wasn't anywhere near Florida. Ray, Robbie, and John could have told you that. They knew it the morning after Miami, and the authorities would all catch on real soon. Jim was far away in Jamaica, about to embark upon the kind of head trip that would really make him fear for his life.
We'll be right back after this word.
It was the fattest joint Jim Morrison had ever seen rolled. It was a joint rolled in a Cuban cigar. The Cuban's rolled leaves struggled to contain the sticky green contents. Before the joint was even out in the open, Jim could smell it. He could sense the high coming from a mile away. This joint announced itself. Jim was in Jamaica for that previously scheduled R&R, having quickly left the shit show in Miami far behind. But there had been a slight change in plans. Jim and Pam had argued so much that Jim decided to go alone. But it wasn't just Pam. Jim needed a minute to decompress away from the rest of the band. Jim was alone at his rented house on the beach in Jamaica. Well, not entirely alone, as there were several housekeepers who were there with him. One of them presented Jim with his stately joint he held in his hand. A monstrous spliff if he had ever seen one. Jim wasn't afraid of a monstrous spliff, as past history provided ample evidence, and so he accepted the housekeeper's offer to get super high. Jim took the jumbo joint in between his thumb and forefinger, lit the end, and inhaled. He exhaled and felt the high hit him like lightning. The housekeeper giggled and said in a thick, deep Jamaican accent, You know I'd be a liar, Mr. Morrison, if I said we couldn't get any higher. He giggled again. Jim's grin slowly got bigger as the joke sank in deeper. Ha, he thought. This guy's all right. Jim felt the highest that he had ever been. His skin tingled, his beard felt like it was on fire. A wind squall kicked up inside his head and blew around in between his ears. The house went dark. He looked through a window and outside was dark too. And there was a distant rumble and then the sky outside lit up. The lightning crackled. The housekeeper was gone. He was right there and now he wasn't. Jim felt around in the dark in front of him. No one. His body was vibrating now, and the distant rumbling outside was getting closer. What was in that joint? He stumbled from one room into the next, his feet clumsy concrete blocks, his arms weighted, and there was sand inside his loose shirt. Sand was pouring from his cuffs onto the floor. It kept coming. So much sand, his shirt sleeves, it never emptied. His face vibrated, and he pointed his eyes downward. His beard was squirming, moving alive. In one blink, he thought he saw snakes in his beard. In the next blink, it looked more like bugs, big black beetles. He swatted at his beard in the dark, desperate to exorcise whatever was lurking inside. And then, a voice. Mr. Morrison. That thick, deep Jamaican voice again. Mr. Morrison. Jim turned around in the dark. Behind him, the housekeeper had returned. Reappeared just as strangely as he had disappeared, but something was different. He had been wearing a loose-fitting white shirt and pants, linen, Jim had thought. But now he was in all black. He was hooded. His outfit blended into the back of the room, and most of what Jim was able to make out were just his eyes when they blinked and his mouth when it moved. The wind squall in Jim's head kicked up again, and he felt his beard heat up and squirm. Mr. Morrison, it's time to die. Outside, lightning flashed again, and for a split second, Jim saw what appeared to be himself, reflected in the window. Only it wasn't a reflection of his body at the moment, standing in a room in a house somewhere in Jamaica. His body was bloated, his eyes closed heavily, his mouth gaping open. He was lying down, motionless. Jim felt strange. Faces come out in the rain. You're strange. Jim shut his eyes tight, wanted it all to go away. He dropped to his knees, fell forward flat on his stomach. The blackness enveloped him. Behind his closed eyelids, more blackness. Nothingness. Back home, the cancellations rolled in. The backlash of the Miami concert was in full effect. The biggest tour of the Doors' career, it wasn't happening. Nothing was happening. The Doors were dead in the water. First, Jacksonville, Florida canceled. The mayor wanted to show some solidarity with Miami and pulled the plug on the show before it even happened. Other cities followed suit. Dallas, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Cincinnati, Cleveland, Detroit, Toronto, Boston, Buffalo, Syracuse. The tour was dead on arrival. There was no tour, and there was about to be no Doors. Commercial radio stations all across the country banned the Doors from the airwaves. The money the band had made from their most recent single, the ironically named Touch Me, would be funneled to pay for legal fees. All in all, Miami would cost the band at least $500,000 in lost revenue. In late March, there was a knock at the Doors' office in Los Angeles. Bill Siddons answered. It was the FBI. They were charging Jim with unlawful flight. He had left the country, and there were warrants for his arrest. Where is Jim Morrison? The FBI asked Bill. Bill wanted to call bullshit on the whole thing. The reports were so mixed about what actually happened that night in Miami, and no one had come forward with convincing proof that Jim had actually exposed himself. And there were scores of kids with Kodak Instamatic cameras in the audience that night, and not one person had snapped a photo at the supposed moment of exposure. But still, it was the FBI. Bill knew when to fight and knew when to play nice. For the FBI, he'd behave. Bill scrambled. He had to track down Jim, cut the vacation short before a bad situation got even worse. He bought some time with the feds, got on the phone. It took him a few calls to get through to someone, anyone, at the house where Jim was staying. But one of the housekeepers answered the phone, and Bill asked to speak with Jim. "Well, Mr. Siddons," the housekeeper replied, "that may be a little difficult. We are trying to determine whether or not Mr. Morrison is actually alive or dead. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is the 27 Club. All right, the 27 Club is scored and co-written by myself, Jake Brennan. Zeph Lundy is the lead writer and editor on the show. Matt Bowden mixes the show. Additional music and score elements by Ryan Spraker and Henry Lunetta. The 27 Club is produced by myself for Double Elvis in partnership with iHeartRadio. Sources for this episode are available at doubleelvis.com on the 27 Club series page. The 27 Club is released weekly every Thursday. Season 1 features 12 episodes on Jimi Hendrix, which are all available for you to binge right now, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, please be sure to subscribe to the 27 Club on Apple Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your shows. And if you'd like to win a free 27 Club poster designed by the man himself, Nate Gonzalez, then leave a review for 27 Club on Apple Podcasts or hashtag subscribe to 27 Club on social media. And we'll pick two winners each week and announce them on the Double Elvis Instagram page. That's at Double Elvis. And you're going to want to give that a follow. So get out there and spread the word about 27 Club. And as always, you can find me blabbing about other crazy rock stars on my other show, Disgraceland. And you can talk to me per usual on Instagram and Twitter at DisgracelandPod. Rock and roll.